that when it comes to the environment, this is a topic that needs to be discussed, because again, it's not a question of overpopulation via landmass, it's overpopulation in terms of resources, in terms of where population, concentrated populations are. And South Florida, obviously, is one. Southern California is another. New York is another. Look, we saw the effects of it during COVID. We saw where the over-densely populated areas are and where there was a high concentration of cases and deaths and things like that. So when people say that it's not an issue, I refuse to accept that premise, that it's not an issue.
No, it's an issue. There are definitely places that have too many people, but it comes into play also. There's this intersection between overpopulation and environmental justice. And there's issues when you're talking about certain populations that don't have access to healthy food, other populations that do. You have migration patterns of people that are going to be coming from the poor, more desolate places that are going to be most affected by climate crisis. We're going to see significant refugee increase from climate crisis. And so it's an issue. It's definitely an issue. And I'm telling you, all it takes is me spending an hour driving in Pembroke Pines, and I'm like, there are just too many people.
And with that said, we would like to welcome what I would consider a very renowned author and somebody who knows a thing or two about the environment in a way that I don't think a lot of people really think about it. Natural resources is it's a serious issue now. And in the state of Florida, it's a very serious issue, because we're not talking about the things that are going on that don't make the headlines, like Nestle taking 1 million gallons of water out of one of our only clean drinking water lakes that we have in the state. It's a big deal. And Mr. Ehrlich wrote this book, The Population Boom, back in a very significant year in American history, which is 1968. A lot has obviously changed since then, but there's a lot of relevancy to what he did write about. And so without further ado, the president of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University, Mr. Paul Ehrlich.
And is it Ehrlich or
Ehrlich? It's Ehrlich. It's like it was E-R-L-I-K.
Paul, I think the best possible place for us to start, because I would like you to take us back in time to 1968, what was the general reaction from people at the time when your book came out?
Well, the book itself did one thing, and that is that Arthur Godfrey read it, loved it, sent it to Johnny Carson, and Johnny had me on The Tonight Show something like 20 to 25 times.
Wow. And that
produced a reaction. We had started the organization Zero Population Growth, ZPG, and John allowed me to give the address I did it three times in a row, I think early in 69. I can't remember exactly when. And when I first went on the show, the ZPG had six chapters and I think something like 600 members. And when the three appearances after them, it was 600 chapters and 600,000 members. And the first show resulted in the biggest delivery of mail ever to an address in Menlo Park, California, where the headquarters of ZPG was. And what this taught me is the power of the mass media, because I'd been giving talks on San Francisco Bay Area radio and television stations for some time, but going on The Tonight Show just changed my life and certainly brought the issue to public attention. The funniest thing, John and I got along very well. The first time I went on the show, Julius LaRosa was a singer that's probably none of you young people have ever heard of.
All right, you can come on anytime. Keep calling me the young people. Keep it up. Yeah.
Well, he got up after the first split, after the first show, during the commercial break, after the first segment, and jumped and ran in front of John and said, you guys can't talk about stuff like this on television, because we talked about contraception. And John said, we just talked about it. And he points to his chest and says, it gets people up here. And I said, no, Julius, it gets people down there. And John said, that's right. It gets people down there, pointing in the right direction. And he said, I don't know what you guys are talking about, and disappeared. And John, that was the last time Julius appeared on the show, but it was funny. We had a good time. And John and I always had a good time.
Let me ask you if you could, just because there is definitely a generational issue in terms of the people who are in this chat and are watching. So if you could just briefly give it like the synopsis of what the population bomb was about, what you were talking about back then, and then we could talk about what has happened and where it has ended up now.
Well, what I was talking about back then is very similar to what all scientists are talking about now. Namely, you cannot grow anything forever on a finite planet. And the Rachel Carson had basically introduced environmental problems to the American public. There was stuff before that, but the literature hadn't taken hold the way Rachel's did. But she did not really discuss in any detail the population dimension of the problem. And I had been emphasizing that that should not be ignored. People will say, the only thing I care about, but that's their interpretation. The book, The Population Bomb, the original title that we gave to Ian Ballantyne, who invented the pocketbook, when we wrote it, at his request, by the way, we called it Population Resources Environment. And that is still the basic story. It's not all population. It's the biggest problem is overall consumption. And of course, how much you consume is a product, that is a multiplication of how many people there are and how much each individual on average consumes. And a third factor was added by us along in 1970, I think, pointing out that it also depended on what technologies you used to service the consumption. It's very, very simple. It's something that every scientist who has an IQ of over 20 understands. Unhappily, most politicians don't have that high an IQ. And so we're still in the kind of trouble we were in back then, except with much less time to do anything about it.
Yeah.
I really think this is an important conversation, because the misconception that a lot of people have when it comes to the issue of overpopulation,
like it's a myth. Overpopulation's a myth.
Not even so much that it's a myth, it's this idea that they're thinking about it in terms of general land mass. But as you know, most of the population centers center in very specific areas. We are in South Florida, you are in the Bay Area. There are, to say that it's overpopulated is saying it in a very kind way. You know, California is probably an even better example than Florida. Florida is massively overpopulated, especially all over the coastlines. California has the same problem. I think it's like, and quote me, tell me if I'm wrong. If it's like 80 to 90% of California's population is within 10 miles of the coastline, all the way from the top end of the state down to the bottom.
Yeah, but you're missing a basic point. That is, the coastline of California, Florida is going to go underwater. We all know that, but it's not going to go fast. You're going to be able to outwalk it if you're on the Florida thing. But the issue is not people versus space. It's people versus resources. And the resources include the garbage cans, like the atmosphere where we're putting all the carbon. And the resources include the groundwater that you were mentioning. And what's going to happen from climate disruption, which is just one of the existential threats we face, is yes, sea level is certainly going to rise as it gets warmer. That's basic physics. But much more important is it's already hitting agriculture. We have a population now of on the world of almost 8 billion people, of which roughly 3 billion can't afford to eat well enough to be actually functional, whereas somewhere in the vicinity of 600 to 800 million are actually starving. And now we are attacking agriculture, And agriculture, the food system on the planet, is responsible for about a third of the greenhouse gases that go into the atmosphere. So as we try to increase our food supply, we are attacking our climate. And anybody who has a garden or a tropical fishbowl knows that organisms are tuned, have evolved to fit into certain temperature zones. When you change the temperature very rapidly, you screw up agriculture. And that's what we're in the process of doing, and that's what the data show. A paper by on this general topic just last year had 15,000 scientists sign on to it, but it was the second edition of one that we produced back in the early 1990s. The situation has not changed significantly since the population bomb, except we just had 4 years of the most incompetent administration the world has ever seen in the leading nation, which set us way, way back. So I would say in some ways, we were pushed back before 1968, but at least in 1968, we still had the potential to do something about it. End of sermon.
No, no, it's true. And
I'm here for it, my friend.
Look, there's also, you know, and that doesn't even, you know, you talk about food production. We also have a significant military industrial complex contribution to our climate crisis that's very massive. But on the food issue, we lack sustainability in agricultural practices all over because sustainable agriculture is not as profitable as industrialized agriculture. And we would all be better off if we were all sustainably farming, gardening, living, you know, more plant-based lives.
Actually, a scientist named Claire Kremen published a year or so ago a really interesting study which shows that you could actually produce as much food with a reasonable agricultural system than with the present industrial one, whether we'll ever do it. I mean, the big issue isn't could we change our ways in such a way as to make it possible for my great-grandchildren to live in a decent world? And the answer is probably yes. Will we do it? When I look around and I see, for example, that people are fighting over whether to wear masks, when you realize that in order to deal with the existential threats, of which climate change is just one, you're going to have to change your entire culture. You're going to have to not have a totally financialized system of economics, and economics departments in most universities totally lacking anyone who has a clue about how the world works. The changes that are going to be required are so dramatic, and the response to very sensible things like mask wearing is so stupid that I can't be totally optimistic. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, people are not exactly really very sharp. We're creating policy out of profit and fear instead of, you know, reason. And so that's always problematic. And it's interesting because the mask thing is the one that's the no-brainer to me, because of all the COVID stuff that we've been talking about, that's the one thing we know for sure works. When you cover your face and the germs don't spread, it helps. That's why we've had less flu. That's why everybody has been less sick in general, not just COVID, but this year there's been like very low flu outbreaks. So we know it works. But yeah, people just don't want to wrap their heads around it.
All right. We'll dive into it really quick, Paul. I'm sure you've been dealing with this for a very long time. Miss Danger wants to know about the fact that, like, anytime somebody comes up with a suggestion in terms of how to deal with the rapid changes on this planet, that there's always going to be co-option of your message for the purpose of trying to push sterilization and eugenics. What do you say in regards to people who think that your message is being used in the wrong way, for example?
Well, the message is often used in the wrong way. At Stanford, which I've been at for 65 roughly years, we had a Nobel laureate named Shockley, who said that people are color-coded for quality, and guess which ones were the most high quality. And then one of that came out, and that was in, I guess, the 70s or 80s. Everybody asked me whenever I gave a talk, isn't it true that we should stop those people who are not good from breeding? And I always used to say, yeah, And anybody who asks that question clearly is in the group that shouldn't breed. And Charlie Feldman and I wrote a book called The Race Bomb specifically to point out that all the racism has no biological basis in fact at all. That in fact, one could make an argument that people with darker skins are, because they're so treated so badly comparatively because of cultural things, that actually they're probably genetically smarter than people with lighter skins because they've had to make out in a tougher environment than those with light skins. But there is zero scientific support for the kind of racism that pollutes the United States and many other countries. Same thing for gender prejudice. It turns out that women, A, are as capable as men in doing virtually everything that doesn't require full strength, and in many cases they're even good there, but I mean our evolution led to men being physically somewhat stronger, not necessarily able to live longer, but women around the world don't get a break. There isn't a single country in the world where women have the opportunities and the pay and so on that men get. And interestingly, one of the ways to deal with the population problem that if we're going to do it humanely, we have to do, one of the first things you should do is give women full rights and opportunities, because it turns out when you do that, they tend to have lower fertility. They tend to choose to have fewer children. So the racism is something one has to deal with in everything in our society, the sexism as well. And if you're interested in seeing to it that we start the kind of slow shrinkage that we must have if the population is ever to be sustainable, one of the first things to work on is women's rights. So winner.
That's interesting. So that's a really interesting correlation. And yes, it's completely commonsensical when I think about it, because if women have equal opportunities, they're going to be pursuing a myriad of other things and not just staying home and breeding.
Right.
And so, right. I mean, that does make sense.
Come on. Who had a choice of having a child or a motorcycle would choose the child? I mean,
no, see, if you said dog or child, I would say, all right, you know,
that's a true Californian.
Okay.
Right there.
Yes.
And even to this day, Paul, I still have not seen Easy Rider, but it is a movie that I need to see. I am going to see it one of these days. But, you know, you bring up a really great point about, you know, women not necessarily, you know, feeling the need to, you know, just be homebodies and take care of children. I'm curious, because of the timing of your book, did what was presented on The Tonight Show have any impact when it came to Roe v. Wade? Was that even something that did more or less play some role in terms of that particular landmark legislation a few years later?
I don't think so. The most interesting thing out of Roe versus Wade was the great plunge in crime rates about 20 years after it was passed, because, of course, wanted children end up often being very much more responsible than unwanted children who are not treated properly. Roe versus Wade, as far as I'm concerned, is primarily an issue in two ways. One is, of course, just plain equity, women being able to make their own choices about how their bodies are operated. And two, anti-abortion laws, particularly in the earlier days, were simply laws that encouraged the murder of women because as the statistics showed, abortion rates didn't change when you made anti-abortion laws, but women's death rates changed. Opposition, it's a good example. It's not a huge demographic issue. In other words, abortion has never been at a level where it made a significant dent in population statistics. Right. So you want to see significant dents, look at the population composition of France, say, from 1910 to 1930 or something like that. Then war can make dents in population growth, although not really significant ones unless we have a full-scale nuclear war, which is one of the existential threats tied to population quite tightly, which the people who understand what's going on in India and Pakistan realize could end our civilization tomorrow. Climate change will end our civilization if we don't do dramatic things about it in a few decades. But if India and Pakistan go at it with their now hundreds of nuclear weapons, as the most recent studies show, we're all screwed. So,
Vice did a great piece on that about 6-7 years ago. I remember that very well.
We have a question.
We do have an important question. One of the things that we do here in South Florida, I think there are two things at the local level you really can do in terms of how you can help make an impact as far as the climate is concerned. That is, you know, work on a plastic ban. And one of the things that we're doing is building community gardens. If you can speak to the issue of factory farming, I think that that probably is... you know, like community gardens can really help reduce the carbon footprint. In terms of factory farming, how much that has played a role in increasing our carbon footprint, maybe as much as anything.
Well, factory farming in general has got one advantage, and that is it was, when it was developed, highly productive, and that did the so-called Green Revolution at great ecological cost. Did allow more people to be fed, although fixing up distribution would have done a much better job. I think that, in my point of view, the best thing about doing gardening and so on is, in part, it cuts the huge fossil fuel input, which makes the food system so bad from the point of view of the food system being able to operate in the right climate. But it also teaches people things. That is, if you've had a farm, if you've had a garden in New York City, say, and you planted palm trees in it, you found in the winter that the palm trees kind of disappeared. And that would bring to you the idea that actually, if you change the temperature, you're going to affect plants, and it's plants that we have to eat. So that changing the temperature rapidly is not a clever idea for a species that somebody called Homo sapiens, the wise man. Of course, it clearly the women were the wise ones. But I'm very much in favor of changing the agricultural system to a more ecologically sustainable one, and spreading agriculture over places, for example, where there are now lawns. I mean, in much of the United States, people take an exotic grass, a foreign grass, and grow it everywhere rather than growing food or growing native plants that are part of ecosystems that we want to maintain because they support our lives. People don't understand that we are utterly dependent on what now finally ecologists are pointing out, and a few smart economists are taking up the idea of natural capital. That is, we are depleting our natural capital, which is our life support systems, which bring us fresh water, which bring us food, other little things like that that we tend to like. And we are getting rid of it as fast as we can. It's as if we were the profligate son of a rich family who inherited a huge amount of money and discovered that he could write a bigger check every year and never look at the balance in his account. And the account is running dry. Good example is the pumping out of aquifers in places like Florida, particularly where when sea level rises, you're going to lose freshwater aquifers just from that. And you're going to lose agricultural land. But again, I don't like the emphasis on sea level rise. People can latch on to that, but the food situation is much more immediate and will be much more difficult to solve. You can always walk away from the sea level rise and build further inland. But if you haven't got food, you can't walk. So
no, it's true. One thing I wanted to ask you about, I was looking at the article that you sent over, and a huge issue, and we've talked about it before, is biodiversity loss and what that... It's like everything is connected. We all know everything. Well, not we all know, but I know that everything is connected. And so when you're talking about the extinction of like a million species and how that's connected to what we're doing, and I was just wondering if you could talk about that and how that's going to affect us. I mean, obviously, We know certain species, like obviously if there's no bees, we have a problem. But just in general, just loss of all of our critters.
Well, oh, it's not just our, I mean, and it is our critters, of course, because one of the things that's often missed in the discussion of sea level rise is the acidification of the oceans. And for most of us, seafood is very important. Most of us in rich countries, to have a healthy diet, a chunk of seafood is really important. But for many millions of people, it's life itself. In other words, the critical protein for many people, particularly in tropical areas and areas where there are coral reefs, it's artisanal fisheries on coral reefs that supply the critical protein to people. So one of the things we're doing, acidifying the oceans, which comes from putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We're taking past sunlight and using it now. And the so that's a critical thing. Also, freshwater and the wetlands of the world are critical in many ways. The wetlands purify the water. Coastal wetlands are often the nurseries for fisheries that support everybody. The forests sequester carbon and change the climate. When people think about, well, who cares if the Amazon is cut down? Well, if I was going to show you out the window here, we have very heavy winds right now, off and on in California. And of course, one of the things that's happening is we're changing the climate. There's more drought. And guess what? That leads to more and more intense forest fires. And
of course,
November in 2019, Ann and our second home is in Australia. And we were in Sydney with the forest there burning, on getting the smoke. And then we came back to California and California was burning. And that's going to get worse and worse and worse. And again, the biodiversity all ties into that. We are part of biodiversity. We depend on all the other organisms to create ecosystems in which human beings can survive and thrive. And wiping out a species is what people focus on, but it's, again, the wrong focus. Wiping out of populations, which precedes the species disappearing, is much more critical. For example, if we wiped out the honeybees in North America, it had cost, the last estimate I saw was $20 billion a year, and we'd have a much less nutritious diet. But the bees, if you wiped them out of North America, the species wouldn't have disappeared. It originated in the old world tropics. It's common in Africa. And so what we have to watch is the extermination of populations, and that's what we're seeing all over the place. Again, you young folks wouldn't know, but in Florida, if you drove at night 50 years ago and drove around fast, you'd have to stop the car every once in a while to wipe the bugs off the windshield.
Love bugs. We have love bugs. They're called love bugs.
Yeah. Well, I remember driving through the West in 1945, I think it was, and having to stop to pull the butterflies out of the radiator of the car. That's all gone. I first went to Costa Rica to do field work 30 years ago, 40 years ago, we used to be able to hang up a cloth, put a light on it, and get thousands of moths of hundreds of species coming to it. No more. In other words, we're wiping out the insects, but who cares about bugs? Well, the birds do, and the plants do. And if you like birds, and you like plants, and you like to eat plants, you want to have the bugs. It's a very complicated system. And of course, the ones that do the best are the ones that are least helpful to us. That is, the parts of biodiversity that thrive are, for example, the rodents like rats who carry our diseases. The pests that attack our crops, because there are fewer because of the laws of thermodynamics, there are fewer things that eat crop pests than there are crop pests. And the smaller populations go first. And so you lose some of the control over the pests and you get less food. Everybody should be taught this stuff starting in middle school at the latest. But our educational system is totally broken. We have the pandemic illustrated that the average human being in North America, and certainly the average congressperson and politician in general, did not understand exponential growth. In other words, they'd say stupid things like, well, there's just four cases here. And the speed with which four cases can turn into 400,000 cases is almost instantaneous if you understand exponential growth. But people don't.
And this is why I'm not a politician, people, because I understand that. So
speaking of politicians, you know, Pelosi is your congresswoman. I would imagine that she doesn't really pay any attention to this, much less anything. Could you talk about just the complete disconnect that our elected officials really have to these types of issues? I mean, there are some that are good. You know, Ro Khan is good.
Yeah, there are. And there are some that are good. And they are also, the good ones are faced with dealing with now a large group of insane ones who are not only stupid, but evil. And that's not a great situation. But again, it traces back to the broken educational system.
Yes.
One of the worst of the insurrectionists, the traitors that promoted the attack on our Capitol, got a bachelor's degree from Stanford University, to our utter dismay and disgust. It's because the university is probably the best university in the world, and it would be an excellent university for the 19th century. Whether Stanford could ever be dragged into the 20th century is still an open question. It has got no leadership in that direction at all. And you can get all the way through Stanford University, the best university in the world, without knowing what natural capital is, without knowing what the laws of thermodynamics are, without knowing anything basically about how the world works, particularly if you major in the econ department, where there's only one faculty member who understands how the world works. Out of dozens.
Considering you've lived quite an extraordinary life, you were born in the Depression, you've lived through multiple wars, I'm curious if there was a particular point in our history where you kind of looked at that moment and said, yeah, this is pretty much where things really started going to hell. I mean, I always point to Jack's assassination as the moment where the country really changed, and it kind of hasn't been the same since then. There was a succession of issues that happened.
I love how he says that like he was there. Like he remembers that.
I'm sure that Paul remembers November 22nd, 1963 very well, but I'm also sure that there may have been other moments. So I'm curious, from your perspective, what would you say really was sort of that, if there was one particular moment where you said, yeah, this is really not going to go well for us?
It was more my interest in the Second World War. My brain was not fully myelinated during the Second World War because I had not yet gotten to the late 20s when your brain is finally where it physically grown to the point where it should. So I wanted to fight in it. I wished the war would last until I could get into it because the propaganda was such. But what really led me down the drain was when I started to learn what was going on in terms of the environment and in terms of nuclear war. I was interested in the, I became a pilot. I was not a pilot at the time, but I was during the war, very interested in the air forces and the airplanes and so on. And when I started to read about what happened, and particularly the firestorms in the bombing of Hamburg, and in bombing Japanese cities and so on, and I began to put that together with nuclear weapons, I began to understand that we were in a position to actually destroy the entire world, that we could wipe out almost everybody, maybe everybody. And of course, my training was in evolutionary biology and in where human beings came from. That's what I used to lecture on. The way I got involved with the population bomb was that I lectured. I had a 10-week course in evolution. The first 9 weeks were where people had come from, and the last week was where people were going. And those lectures became well known to Stanford students and alumni, and I started getting invitations to talk on Bay Area radio shows and so on about population and the environment. And Dave Brower, who was he was famous for his work in the Sierra Club, and Ian Ballantyne, who invented the pocketbook and was working with Dave on environmental books, came to Ann and me and said, could you write down what you've been saying in your lectures in a short book, and we'll see if we can influence the election in 1968. And show how naive even people like Dave and Ian could be. But Ann and I spent a couple of weeks writing it down, and that's where the population bomb came from. And to my continued dismay and disgust, I allowed Ian to say the book will be much better if it only has one author. And also, and so I, Ann and I decided we'd leave her name off, which was a big mistake as far as I'm concerned. The book may have sold better with only one name, but anyway, we're 65 years into the argument now, so I guess we managed to survive it. But
a lot of people may or may not know the full trajectory of Reagan's presidency. Could you talk about what it was like having him as your governor, and perhaps where people may not recognize that he had a lot to do with a lot of the, I think from an environmental standpoint, he was really somebody who kind of just revolutionized this whole concept of, you're an individual, get yours while you can, and run over everybody you have to in order to get it if need be.
That's a time that that's what I thought we started going backwards. In other words, if you think about it, even Nixon, for example, he was a crook, but he was a smart politician and realized that there was importance in environmental issues. And during his administration, EPA. The Republicans started to put in what, on a worldwide basis, they were inadequate, but they were the first laws trying to deal with clean air, clean water, biodiversity, and so on. And Reagan just reversed it. And then, of course, it went steadily downhill from there with some minor changes. But I have to admit that I've known a lot of people in politics. I have had friends in both the Senate and the House and so on. And we all sort of used to think of ourselves as knowledgeable about, after all, if you're interested in the environment, you know that the big issues are political. The changes that have to be made are not, we don't need to know any more science to know what we ought to be doing. We already know what we ought to be doing. The issue is, why in hell aren't we doing it? But none of us, I don't have a single friend who would claim that he foresaw what a disaster Trump could create. I mean, that is beyond belief, and it's still beyond belief. I mean, after all, you have hundreds of morons in political positions in Washington who refuse to even look at the causes of something we all observed and almost wiped them out. I mean, the levels of evil and stupidity that have been created by Donald, whatever his name is, are beyond belief. And I feel really, by the way, I once met Joe Biden, had a very high opinion of him. Ann and I had a discussion with him in an empty stairwell on Lake Como in Italy. He would never remember it. He was a senator at the time, but we were both impressed. But he is faced basically with what Abraham Lincoln was faced with, if you know the history of the 1840s, 50s, and 60s.
Yeah. He does, because he's that guy.
And I must say, I think he's done a wonderful job, better than I thought he would. But boy, it's a knife-edge issue whether we're just going to go down the drain politically and not do anything at all about the existential threats to humanity and to our children.
That's a great segue. So what is your opinion of the Green New Deal? I mean, obviously, it's a very wide-reaching piece of legislation. But on its surface, obviously, the ideas behind it, which, you know, Jen and I both agree, the idea of moving forward with a infrastructure plan that centers around clean energy jobs, I think, I mean, obviously, it's one step in the right direction. But on a grander scale, I'm curious as to how you feel that legislation has been crafted. And if it is something that has potential, because it does seem like the millennial and Gen Z generations are fully on board with the direction we need to go in as far as the environment is concerned.
Should I ask? That's a question I would have to ask Anne, because she follows that stuff closely. You summarized my view in your first sentence. One step in the right direction. A small step in the right direction.
What's the most critical thing to do, Paul? Like, what would be, like, if you could wave a magic wand, like, what would be the first thing that we would really need to do to set things in motion?
I would start on a massive campaign, A, to educate the public, B, for example, people talk about how we got to go to electric cars. What we have to go to is mutual ownership of cars, maybe 12 people per car, and using them forever and only for certain kinds of things. Redesigning our cities the world's cities, away from suburbs and spread, concentrating where the people are. The Chinese have plans to pave the entire world in their I can't remember the name of the program. You know, they try to take over Africa. Senior moment. I can't remember the name of their famous plan. It's replacing the Silk Road with freeways, basically. Because after all, cars contribute to climate change not just by what they burn. They spew rubber into the air. The rubber has to come from somewhere. They have to be manufactured. You have to lay down roads, which is always laid over biodiversity, and we have to start a program of stop at one child for a long time to gradually get the human population down to a sustainable level. There's a very famous economist in England who just did a huge study. His name is Partha Dasgupta, and he just did a huge study for the British government on the economics of biodiversity. Partha thinks we might manage to create a sustainable world at, I think, about a Mexican level of standard of living if we had about 3.5 billion people, less than half the number we have now. An estimate that Anne and I and Gretchen Daly made in the 1990s was 2 billion, and maybe 1.5 billion if you wanted to be safe. But the point is, there is nobody who's looked at the situation who doesn't think there should be, to be safe, there should be many fewer people than today. What the actual number will be can be decided during the next 30, 40, or 50 years while we move in that direction and decide what the target is as we get to know more about what the problems are of creating a shrinking population, an economy that is based on shrinkage, not on growth, an economy where it is not necessary for everyone to have a cell phone, a new one every 3 months. The super consuming life, I'll tell you something you can't know. And that is, from the point of view of basic living, I was as happy in 1956 as I am today, or happier. For example, I had a car. I had a refrigerator that would keep beer cold. I had actually had a television set that you could see stuff on. It wasn't color yet. But the things that make your life reasonable were all available back then when the world had half the people that it has today. Economists have looked at this carefully. There is absolutely no gain in well-being or pleasure or happiness once you have the basic things, the basic shelter, food, some opportunity for education and entertainment and so on. The multiplying of the GDP in countries like the US, UK, Europe, Japan, and so on did not bring happiness to people, did not bring well-being. So we're stuck in an insane system. And until we get people to realize it and ask what they really want out of life, you know, in 1956, you could make love just like today, maybe even better if you're my age.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that we can look at this and say, is it really population or is it overconsumption? And then you can break it down and look at, obviously, in this country, we consume way more than everybody else. Like we're beyond overconsumption. And I think some places are better at managing that than others. And it's like, it's a balance between the amount of population and the amount that each person is consuming. But I don't think it's something where if we just all drive electric cars and compost, that everything's going to be okay, because these are things that have to be dealt with on a massive scale at a government level and really deal with massive systems. It's not a matter of everybody recycling.
You're correct. In fact, for most of our history, if you want to just look at Homo sapiens, modern human beings, we have a 300,000 year history, almost all of it as small group hunter-gatherers. We were, until 12,000 years ago or so, when the agricultural revolution started, we lived in very small groups, sometimes as many as 100 or 150, but they were equitable. Nobody could be rich. Nobody could hold slaves because you're moving around all the time. Hunter-gatherers don't stay in one place. And all of our big, big problems trace to two revolutions, the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution. And we're a small group animal that has not had time to evolve even culturally how to perform as a large group animal. We're used to living with people of the same kind, the same genetic background, the same color, the same language, and so on. And now we're trying to live in groups of millions and billions. And it's crystal clear we can't do it. But if people realized that, then they might work harder to try and get back more of the cooperation, more of the equity that, you know, in a hunter-gatherer group, you don't have kings and queens. You have a hunt leader who's the best person at tracking. You have a medicine woman who's the one who really understands which plants can give you, relieve your headache, et cetera. You had somebody who everybody liked who was the dispute solver and so on. And a totally different system, which we evolved with. And now we can't sit. For example, one of the important ethical issues that I've never seen discussed in the mass media are borders ethical? You know, the old story, how did our oil get under their sand? The resources are not evenly distributed. How should we share them? Should we have a state system in which you keep other people out or don't deal with it? And as I think I heard you talking earlier, just before I got my voice on this show, the migration situation today is a huge pain in the butt for the government, and it's nothing compared to what's coming. In other words, the whole issue of borders and migration and the ethics of it and the ethics of rich and poor are going to be huge soon, and we're not doing anything to prepare for it or think about it.
We're just going to build bigger facilities in which to incarcerate the people as they come across the border and find a way to profit off of them in the process. That would be my guess.
Are the Europeans going to do when the people from the Middle East keep coming and the Africans have to move up there? One of the really smart economists in the world is Scott Barrett at Columbia. And we've talked casually about what kind of insurance system the countries ought to have so that when a huge burst of migration comes into Greece or comes into Spain, how the other countries will help deal with it and distribute the people and take care of them and so on. And these things are not being discussed even at the EU level, as far as I know.
Yeah. And what's interesting is we keep, you know, we're learning this, like what you were talking about is very interesting because it's really that tribal sort of, you know, our tribal ancestry and how we really are supposed to be working together collectively. And yet we're still going into indigenous places and taking over their sort of, you know, equal, you know, equitable tribal system and putting in big agriculture, taking down their trees, taking over, like they're doing things infinitely better. And yet we're still pushing this system that we now know is creating this mess that we're in. And well, we're still doing it.
Think of what the Western Hemisphere would be like if we hadn't had our microbial allies. In other words, there were millions and millions of people in the Western Hemisphere. There were big cities. There was lots of sustainable agriculture. And we came in and with smallpox and other diseases, wiped them out, basically, and replaced them with our unsustainable system. What can I say? We got a lot of problems. We're going to sure as hell have to try and educate people about them, but whether we can succeed, you know, many years ago when people said, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future? I would say I am optimistic about what we could do. I'm pessimistic about what we will do. I have to say now my pessimism, particularly seeing what Trump did and continues to do and the morons that follow him, have depressed me almost beyond thinking there's any, and this is something true of most of my colleagues, can't see a path to a sustainable future. And that's grim.
I feel inspired a lot by the younger people, by the kids of the Sunrise Movement, by the kids that deal with the climate lobby and all of that stuff, because they are really taking this issue on. And, you know, we'll see if that ever like amounts to real change, real policy, you know, affecting better governance. But the kids these days, like the kids that worked on my campaign, the kids, they're really motivated and they really do care. So, I mean, that's what I look at when I feel a little bit defeatist and I see the kids out and they're still taking a stand and they get it. And they're a lot more informed about things than we were, than I was at that age. So, I mean, that's my sense of optimism, is that I see a lot of the young people really standing up.
Well, I agree with that. Both of us wonder whether they can actually get the job done. Yes. Are there enough of them? Yes. And will people listen to them? But, you know, I keep doing things like this because I hope maybe we can get the job done. I just can't be super optimistic about it.
Yeah, I'm with you, but that's why we're doing this show. That's why we do this show. We have
that's exactly why I'm here.
And building,
I could be having a drink right now. You know,
go have a drink. Oh my God! Well, we'll wrap up, so you can go have your beverage.
And I will leave.
Oh my
you with
God!
This.
It's happy hour out there. It's happy. He's well into happy hour in California.
I will say this, Paul, and I'll leave you with this. I do think that our greatest asset and our greatest detriment at the same time is technology. I do think one of the real downsides to every person now having a cell phone, especially, and I'm sure you would agree with this, especially people who end up getting a cell phone way too early in their cognitive development, you know, it stunts a lot of growth. On top of that, a lot of people are not opening books the way they used to.
It may actually be involved in the increase in nearsightedness that we're having in the world. And maybe that may be also because of artificial light, but also maybe people not looking into the distance. But that's one of the, I could send you a wonderful paper about the mismatch, because we've brought hunter-gatherer genes into a McDonald's world. That's why that's why people have braces. Why do you figure that human beings need braces? Because their jaws have been shrinking dramatically since the agricultural revolution, because they don't get the right sleep and exercise. Right.
Well, so, I know we don't get the nutrition. Teeth. Look, what is the nutritional content of a red pepper today is not the same as it was when I was a kid. And so when you see things like vision issues, increase in juvenile diabetes, you see all of these. Just we're very, obviously we don't have healthcare as a priority here either, but a lot of this to me has to do with depleting the nutrients in our food and the chemicals in our soil and our water.
You know, one of the main reasons the nutrients are going out of our food is the carbon going into the atmosphere, because the plants don't spend as much time sucking up the nutrient, the other nutrients they need, because they're able to get the energy they need from the CO2. What can I say?
It's all connected. But so I'm right. We are having less nutritional value to our food.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the big consequences of climate change, of the put the greenhouse gases. But I can tell you, and I'll have to leave after this, but solution to all of this, the solution is drink really good wine and keep your internal environment in good shape while the external goes down the drain. So that's Dr. Ehrlich's prescription.
Thank you. And I told you it was Ehrlich and not Ehrlich.
Okay, Ehrlich.
Excuse me.
Remember, Ehrlich means honest or honorable in German. And with me, it's false advertising. Take care.
You have been an absolutely
fantastic guest. Thank you so much.
We certainly hope you will come back. Please, guys, if you haven't.
I've enjoyed it thoroughly. I'd love to come back sometime.
Thank you.
The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich.
Why can't you say Ehrlich?
Just Ehrlich. E-R-L-I-K.
Yes. The H is silent.
Oh, and now I'm going to really tick
off.
Both
H's are silent.
I went to Rutgers, my education should have shown a lot better.
Thank you so much.
I lived in New Jersey in those days. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.